1 Fox 3, Bullseye 060, 25, 16,000.
This is XTP Media.
So, a phenomenal aeroplane with the big engine, the Mark 107, a lot of power, a lot of performance, and a real enviable array of munitions that you could carry on her.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. For takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello, everybody. I'm Gareth Stringer, the editor of Global Aviation Resource, and this is episode 108. Of Extended. I'm going to be your host for this episode. It might be our last one of the year. It probably will be. You'll have to wait and see because you never know what's going to happen. But I'm delighted to say the whole team has assembled. And that means that Peter Johnson from XTP Media is here. Peter, how are you?
I'm fabulous. I'm looking forward to Christmas and all those great aviation books that people are going to send me.
You got Santa's going to drop a few off, is he?
I hope so. Fingers right. crossed, and we'll maybe see. Flight sim as well.
Oh my goodness, that's a bit greedy.
Fingers crossed.
Get your hopes up. Somebody who's already got flight sim is Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society. He's also the editor of Aerospace. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes, good to be here.
Good. Santa bringing you a few aviation-related Christmas presents?
There's a whole list of aviation books and things that is dropping on Matt's. Yeah, so yeah.
Excellent. Well, when we reconvene in the new year, we shall let everybody know what arrived and what we've got and what's good and what went back to the shops. we are mainly talking Harrier tonight, folks. On the 15th of December 2010, so literally just over 10 years ago, almost to the day, the Harrier quite literally bowed out from UK military service. We're going to have a chat about that and the interview that's coming up in a second, but you're about to hear from Air Vice Marshal Gary Waterfall. Gary was the last Force Commander of Joint Force Harrier. He'd been a Harrier pilot for almost his entire Royal Air Force career. He was also in the Red Arrows, but he flew the Harrier JR3, JR5, JR7, JR9. And on that fateful day, that fateful and very cold day at RAF Cottesmore, he was the last person to land in a UK military Harrier. And I'm couching that slightly just in case we ever get a civilian one, but I don't know what the likelihood is of that. Probably not very high, unfortunately. So it was an absolute pleasure to catch up with Gary for the first time pretty much in 10 years. So let's hear from Air Vice Marshal Gary Waterfall. Gary, firstly, where's 10 years gone for a start?
Hey, 10 years has rushed by, hasn't it? You know, it's incredible to think 15th of December 2010 is almost 10 years ago, as it will be later this month.
And I'm interviewing you on a very cold, very grey, very wet day, which I have to say reminds me of the 15th of December from 10 years ago. So that's quite appropriate. When you think back now, what's the first thing you think of when you look at that period of time and, you know, the conclusion on the 15th?
I think for me, Gareth, it was just a clash of all emotions. You know, my own personal feelings about what was happening at the time with my own, you know, personal issues that I had to deal with, And yet being, you know, the station commander at Cottesmore, the commander of the joint force, on my shoulders really sat the reputation of the force, of the Harrier, not just for the people that were fortunate to fly it and engineer it and be with it at the end, but the people through the whole life of it. And I look back, you know, with a lot of respect, frankly, for the way that people carried themselves over that period, because it was an interesting journey. And I think respect is probably the one thing that I single out when I do look back and the way everyone conducts themselves, the professionalism right to the very end in terms of closing down the engines on that last day.
You couldn't have done that without the people. We will talk about the aircraft in a minute, but I don't want us to forget the people that were involved. And there were obviously people's jobs and careers and futures, and there was a lot of uncertainty involved. But you must be so proud of the way that everybody pulled together to achieve that.
Yeah, Gareth, we lived through, December in 2009, the then Secretary of State announced that Cottesmore was going to close and that we were going to lose one of the Harrier squadrons and collapse back to Wittering. And from that moment on, uncertainty set in pretty much for the whole of the Harrier force. And when I say the Harrier force, it was that collective body of individuals from the team that were lucky enough to fly the aeroplane, to the engineers, the air traffickers, the support people, the civil servants, and of course the families, all of whom there was an implication for that news. And then when we had the news in October 2010 that the Harrier was going to be axed under the defence review, you know, one of the things, the first thing I did really was to say to people, okay, we're going to stay flying. Let's make sure we can stay flying so that everybody who's connected with the Harrier can get all of the qualification experience they possibly can by the time we stop actually flying in December. And had it not been for everybody pulling together, from the people that stood at the main gate all the way through to the people who were sat in the aeroplane, it wouldn't have been the event it was, and indeed it wouldn't have happened.
Where were you from the moment that you knew that the force was going to stand down, of the external pressures as well? There's the media, the broader public, with which, you know, the Harrier is on that, definitely on that list of iconic aircraft that the broader public know about. And obviously, I was a strong presence from the enthusiast community as well. So you had some other boxes to tick as well, didn't you, externally?
Yeah, and I was really lucky. And, you know, I mustn't, you know, single people out as we go through this. But, you know, I know in particular, so Paula Wilmot, who was the media comms woman, you know, and she was just brilliant. Her and her team just galvanised themselves to make sure that when we laid the icon to rest, which is the Harrier, as I talked about it, we could do it in a way that was professional first and foremost, but we could make it as attractive to those people within the current Harrier family, those people that had been before us, the military hierarchy that needed to be around it, but then also the elements of the civilian population, of which Harrier is an icon. I always cite Spitfire. I said to you at the time, Spitfire, Concorde and Harrier are the three icons of British aviation. So from a general civilian population, but also from the specialist aviation press, from a journalism perspective.
What's the highlights? I mean, the last day obviously was extraordinary, despite the weather. You obviously you had a big personal part in that. You know, it was a very nicely painted aircraft that you flew on that last day, and you got to do the last landing. But is it the last day that really resonates, or are there other bits that maybe we're not aware of? I know we were at we went to Wittering and saw Dunk and Goddard, etc., on the day of their last trip, and that was, you know, that's a pretty incredible thing to do, and there must have been lots of highlights like that.
Yeah, there were loads of lasts for people. There were loads of amusing moments as you go through it, and, you know, me sat in splendid isolation as the station commander, and then you find out where people are going on these landaways around UK. And so we think, well, okay, that's fine. I understand that. And then you start to question a couple of them, because it's all about the bounds of reasonableness. Now, of course, why wouldn't they? And I was the person sat back seeing the sum of all of those parts. So very amusing moments going through. As you're well aware, one of the traditions within, you know, the Air Force as aviators for time immemorial has been, you know, burning of pianos, would you believe?
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, stood in the bar on the evening after it all, we stopped flying, and there was a piano made available, and it was burnt outside. and the young junior pilots came in having burnt it stinking of smoke, bumped into me and tried to hide the fact they'd been outside and burning piano, as if I was going to be cross or as if it's the first time I'd ever seen it. So loads of amusing anecdotes when you look back over those couple of months, because that's all it was. But without a shadow of a doubt, the way everyone pulled together on that last day, you know, to put that 16 ship in the air in the way they did it, to have 30 serviceable aeroplanes sat on the ramp at Cottesmore from which to choose 16 to get airborne, was just a real moment for everybody that everybody to this day remains proud of.
And let's not forget as well, we're not just talking about the Air Force, aren't we? It was a joint force. I guess in a lot of ways, it was a sort of proving ground that the two services could come together. You must also, I guess, it's not just you were the commander at the end, but everybody must be very proud of what Joint Force Harrier achieved during its lifetime.
Yeah, definitely. So I've been around Joint Force Harrier pretty much since the inception, working in various jobs. And, you know, to watch, to take command of that Joint Force Harrier was great. To then watch the Navy at work and really, again, proud of the way the OCU was equally manned from the light blue and from the dark blue perspective, and watching people just work in seamless harmony with each other. Now, of course, and we won't touch on it, there are a lot of politics at play in the higher echelons, but those politics stopped at the front gate at Cottesmore and at Wittering. And when you went in behind those gates, it didn't matter of the colour of your cloth you got onto it. And I think, Gareth, now wind the clock forward by 10 years. Look at 617 Squadron at Marham. 617 Royal Air Force Squadron at Royal Air Force Marham has just spent the best part of 2 months probably on HMS Queen Elizabeth and is currently commanded by a Royal Navy commander. Now that, to the military hierarchies in 2010, was unfathomable. And yet there they are today and they're doing it. And one of the reasons they're doing it and they're doing it so successfully is because of the ground that was manured and fertilized in our days of Joint Force Harrier, where we worked seamlessly together.
And we're not going to go into the politics. You just said that. The decision was made. And I guess the irony, I suppose, 10 years down the line, the JR4, bless her, has gone as well. So neither of the two aircraft, which everybody, you know, it was one or the other, is what I guess most people assumed. Let's just talk about the Harrier, though. She came a long way in her lifetime. You got to follow the aircraft through a lot of its career in service and obviously the developments it made. I mean, how good was it in that last little part of its operational lifetime?
Phenomenal, Gareth. Absolutely phenomenal. You know, as you know, I'm now outside of the Royal Air Force and I run my own company. And the company's called Pegasus Potential. Pegasus after the engine. Why is that? It's because my company is based around incrementally improving people's perspective and views into defence and being better as a result. The Pegasus started life with about 8,500 pounds of thrust, that engine did. The physical size of the engine hasn't really changed since the first Pegasus engine to the 107 as we had it, or the 408 it is, that's flown by the US Marine Corps. And yet that's now kicking out 27,000 pounds of thrust from the same physical space. That's just incredible. And you look at the GR9, which was that final variant that we flew, that had helmet mounted sight. It had paved way four. It was doing the Brimstone integration as a close air support platform, you know, unparalleled really in the speed at which that it could react and deliver whatever effect was required to the enemy. And of course, have the flexibility for land-based operations and maritime operations. And those people that have been around the Harrier for a long, long time will say, yes, but what, didn't have much petrol, couldn't go very far. Well, of course, you know, it could go a long way. And also it had air-to-air refueling, as every platform does, to extend that range. So a phenomenal aeroplane with the big engine, the Mark 107, a lot of power, a lot of performance, and a real enviable array of munitions that you could carry on her.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics,
the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
You obviously, so you must have thrown GR3, GR5, GR7, GR9, presumably.
Yeah.
Obviously, the kit changed beyond all recognition. And when you read about people flying GR3s, they talk about, you know, the radios being terrible, the cockpit was a sort of ergonomic nightmare. Those things obviously improved. But did the fundamental stick, throttles, throttle nozzles, was that just the same at the end as it was when you flew it at the, earlier on in your career?
Yeah, but fundamentally easier, thank goodness. I mean, the GR3 was, you know, you're driving a harsh rally car with no anti-skid, no ABS on it, no traction control, none of that rubbish. It's just you and the machine in perfect harmony, rightly or wrongly, when things start to go a little bit awry. Put yourself into the GR7 or the GR9, and you've got a really mature stability system that helps balance out all of the competing demands, particularly as you approach into the hover, where if you were brave enough, you could take your hands off in the hover. I don't think many people ever did. Certainly now in the F-35, you can.
Yeah.
And again, the kit in the aeroplane. You know, when I started flying the GR3, you had this moving map, which was kind of hidden behind the stick that you couldn't really see. Irrelevant anyway, because the inertial platform tied to it used to wander off as you taxied out. So it only gave you an idea of what counter you were in or country. Whereas you take that to the GR9 era, and you've got this pinpoint accuracy and navigation. And you harness that with a weapon system and a bomb such as the Paveway 4, which is now being flown, of course, on Typhoon and indeed on the F-35. And that bomb, you can tell that bomb the angle that you wanted to impact the target, the time you wanted to impact, and actually whether you wanted to go bang above the target when it hits the target or after it hits the target. And all of that is controlled by you in the cockpit, and it will go to exactly the point that you've asked it to go to. So a phenomenal leap forward in technology, but it's got the same stick, and it's got the nozzles, and it's got the throttle. So in terms of that raw aeroplane performance, particularly in the V-stall arena, it's just as raw as it was back in the 60s.
I remember reading or hearing a quote, I think it might have been from Cy Jessett actually, saying basically he wouldn't change it for the world, but it wasn't the most restful piece of thing to go to work in every day.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's not an armchair. Now, the GR3 is really small. GR7, GR9 was a bigger cockpit, but, you know, I'm 6'3", not the most comfortable of aeroplanes to sit in for an 8-hour transit. So it isn't the most comfortable, but it's one of the better places I've ever worked in my life, put it that way, if not the best place.
We mentioned it briefly already. We've got to just talk about the weather in that last few weeks, because it did, in true British fashion, I guess quite appropriately for a British icon, nearly conspire to put the mockers on everything, didn't it?
Yeah, so I'm sure some of your avid listeners will correct and tell me how wrong I am, but when Cottesmore was an active airfield, it was something like the fourth highest airfield in the country, would you believe? And we used to drive out of Stamford as a family to go back to Cottesmore, and the children used to call it going into Narnia, because you'd go up the hill to Cottesmore, and that's where the snow was starting. And we lived through it, and it was awful. We had snow leading up to it. We had snow on the runway. And because Cottesmore was going to be closed, the decision was made to take all of our de-icing capability off us. So we had to wait for the snow to melt. Now, you can operate a Harrier off snow, of course, but it's when it's a mix between the two that it's not very great. So we sat around the days leading up to it, the week before, the weather cleared enough to get the OCU from Wittering, all the aeroplanes up to Cottesmore. And then what we wanted to do on the Monday is we wanted to fly a rehearsal. And the weather just wasn't good enough. And we couldn't get the runway clear, and it just wasn't safe to do so. So what we did is we launched the four tails aeroplanes. So myself in the retro scheme, and then one squadron, the Navy 800 squadron, and four squadron, all got airborne to do a photo shoot with Jamie Hunter.
Yeah.
Which then backed us. We were starting to back into a corner because flying was finishing on the Wednesday. The release service was going to be ripped up at 5 o'clock and went up on Wednesday evening. We knew that. That was the hard stop. So on the Tuesday, we all got airborne and we went up above the clouds. We joined together as a 16 ship, which is where a lot of the photos came from. And then as we went over towards the Marham area, a gap appeared in the cloud. So I said, right, you and my 15 friends, we're going down through the gap. We descended down over Marham and we flew over Marham, Duxford, Witton, flew right over the middle of Stamford, going from south to north and Wittering, up through Scampton and Coningsby. And then we just couldn't get in to Cottesmore. It was socked in. So we pulled up, we split into our four ships and recovered. And that was the scene set then for Wednesday. And the weather was just shocking. A bitter northerly wind.
It was so cold.
And it was 15 knots of wind, which I remember. It couldn't be worse. Right across the runway. Probably the worst it could have been.
But you did it. You know, you all got airborne. It was a quite extraordinary occasion. Just talk me through the last 5 minutes of that final flight.
So we all sat up above the cloud in a 16 ship, and I kind of let everyone be for 5 minutes to have their own quiet moment, really, because the enormity of it certainly hit me, and I thought it was with everybody else. We split into our individual four ships to recover, and the brief was that, you know, I've been the last four ship to come back, and I would have that sort of the last hover and bow, as it were. So as we rushed into the airfield, air traffic did an amazing service. Right. And fed us all in at such great spacing, as I'm sure you remember. There was something going on constantly. And as that first four ship was landing, the next four ship was breaking into the circuit. And I came into the hover. Hovering in a crosswind in a Harrier is really tricky, decelerating into the hover. And having the wind blowing you onto the crowd is probably the worst it can be. And of course, what you need to do is not, when you decelerate, you shouldn't be pointing into the wind. But you can't do that on an occasion like that. So you have to make sure you keep the alpha low, the sides that you have to manage. Came into the hover, turned to face everybody. As I turned, I could see all of the crowd. It was already getting a bit dark. Bowed the aircraft. As I bowed, came out of the bow, I then brought the undercarriage up, which from the ground became quite symbolic because the first thing you saw was the nose light come off and then the gear come up, did a pedal turn. And then, you know, to try and emulate, which I never would do, the great John Farley, then ended up going into a steep climb, not for long, because then I had to bunt because the cloud base was so low, come back around the corner and then land on a pad. And I think it was ingrained forever, 1442 on the 15th of December. And that was the end of British Harrier Aviation.
It was an extraordinary moment, you know, to be there and witness it. But to hear it as well, it's such a distinctive noise, Harrier, and to hear those engines sort of winding down genuinely for the last time was pretty incredible. You all did an incredible job that day. And I think everybody at Cottesmore who put that event on, you know, I hope they're still very proud of what they achieved that day. Listen, you just mentioned him by name. As you know, writing for the website, we were lucky enough to be given an award for our coverage of the retirement. And we subsequently found out that we'd been nominated for that award by John Farley. Now, I know the community, the Harrier community, was very tight and that he was a real sort of legend within it. John sadly passed in March 2018. I just wanted to see if you wanted to say a few words about it. Was such a lovely, lovely guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, first of all, Gareth, you're well done for the award you picked up. Because it was brilliant. The coverage was great. It absolutely did what it should have done on the side of the tin in terms of a recognition and record of what actually occurred on that day. And it's, you know, it's something I've got stored somewhere and every now and then I still refer to it. John Farley, what a gentleman. And I said, you know, I didn't do a Farley climb. And, you know, there are display pilots that have gone before me that pretend that they've done a Farley climb. Nobody's done a Farley climb. The only person that's ever done a Farley climb is John Farley. Yeah. There are people that can fly an aeroplane and there are people that are part of an aeroplane. John Farley was part of the Harrier, and the Harrier was what it was because of John Farley. and it was made for him. It was bespoke for him. And many hundreds of pilots tried to follow in his footsteps and be as good as him. They never could. But the most remarkable thing about John was his humility. His friendship to everybody. And all you had to have was not even some Harrier blood in your veins, a connection, an empathy, an interest. And he would reach out from school children all the way up to retired or serving seniors that he just wants to engage with or wants to engage with him. Never afraid to tell a tale, but always in an instructive way, always inspirational. And frankly, I could have listened to the man for hours.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And yeah, I just wanted to finish before we talk about charitable exploits, because I know you're a keen cyclist. We're going to come on to that in a minute. You've kind of mentioned the legacy a little bit already, because in many ways, it's staring us in the face at RAF Marham, both in the structure, but also the aircraft. And I mean, you know, Harrier hasn't gone, obviously. There are still Harriers flying, but just talk a little bit about the legacy. And I guess John comes into this as well from there's a whole V-style legacy to this as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, the F-35B, had it not been for British ingenuity and innovation, there wouldn't be an F-35B in its current guise. The control laws, the logic that goes into it, is all down to the British ingenuity and expertise. And the Vark Harrier that flew for a long time out of Boscombe, you know, with, you know, great Harrier pilots from, you know, my era, flying it and testing it. The worst thing you could do is put a Harrier pilot in it because he didn't really understand the control laws. Interesting, as an aside, I flew the F-35 Sim, and I came alongside the aircraft carrier, and I was sat there in the hover. I thought, right, I just need to go back a bit. So I did what I would have done in the Harrier, and next thing, I'm starting to rise up in the air. And, oh, no, of course, the control laws don't work that way. So it's
muscle memory.
Oh, it is, but they've synchronized so well. But also, Gareth, the people. You know, I meet people, engineers from the Harrier Force, and support people from the Harrier Force that are at Marham. You know, the boss of the conversion unit, Mox, he is from the Harrier Force, detoured his way there through Tornado. There are people that are flying on 617 that have come from the Harrier Force. Hey, that's not important. What it does show is you've had people, you know, all the way through, peppered all the way through, go on to Queen Elizabeth on this joint venture. And the guy who was Wings, who is now working with the Carrier Strike Group, is Blackers. So Jim Blackmore, who was, you know, one of the execs back on the last day. In fact, he was the last man, I think, to get airborne off Ark Royal in November in the GR9. And he's still around the community. So the community lives on. It's just in a different form, in that fifth gem form, which we all said it was coming. And I think on the day when you interviewed me, stood in front of the aeroplane, as cold as I was, and I said, hey, you know, this is done now. It's done. Today's been a great celebration, laying an icon to rest. This is now about the future. And the future is that fifth gem. It is F-35.
Have you all got together and told Harrier stories? Is that an annual thing?
It might be. It might be an annual thing. So we have... So I set up an association, which is about 1,000 strong. And I was really clear in my mind that the association was for the whole Harrier family. So it's not just restricted to pilots. It's everybody in that family. Very early on, the engineers started their own sort of annual reunion here in Stamford. So I then sort of set up every other year, we have a dinner for those that have been, you know, lucky enough to have flown the airplane or flown in the airplane. And we had one June before last, obviously not this year. Yeah. And we had some 270 of us gathered where no one could hear anyone else. All we did was just talk at each other for a whole evening.
Well, that's brilliant. And I just want to say, you know, thank you for the part that you played. I think it's fair to say these things aren't necessarily always done with that level of success, you know, retirements and things like this, but this one definitely was, so thank you. And just to finish, I mean, you're a busy guy, you're not in the Air Force anymore, you're still very busy, but you're still also, you're raising money for the Royal Air Force Association. I know you're a keen cyclist because I've seen the pictures on social media. I think this is the fourth year you're raising money, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, thanks, Gareth. So one of the things I did in the service and still do out is I'm an ambassador for the Royal Air Force Association. that effectively through welfare target the needs of the Air Force family yesterday, today and tomorrow. Subject clearly dear to my heart, not only because of me and my background, my father was in the Air Force and my mother's father was in the Air Force as well. So it's very much in my blood. And the need has never been greater, obviously, because of COVID. And they target a lot of this into befriending and connecting with those who feel a bit more vulnerable, who can't get out. I started a cycle ride in 2018, the centenary of the Air Force, and it went okay, actually. We had about 100 people riding, which is what I wanted. And we've grown it over years. This year, because we couldn't do a live event, we did it virtually. We had 300 of us, and we raised over £70,000.
Wow.
So next year, we're going global. We're going to have a 24-hour event. There's going to be a live event based in Waltham and the Wolves near Grantham. And there's also going to be a virtual event. And when I say we're going global, we've got people from the west coast of the States all the way through to Australia. We're going to do it over a 24-hour period. You don't have to be serving or retired. It's just really connecting and just literally just entering from which you get a jersey back from. And it's being part of it is raising that spirit. And if you can raise money, that's, you know, even better. But for us, it's about being connected and getting the awareness out there of what the association does, all the really good things it does, and how it connects us all and keeps us all together as a family.
Thank you very, very much for your time, Gary. And yeah, it's much appreciated.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Chaps, the Harrier is, and we're going to talk about this later on as well, an iconic aircraft. That was an amazing day. Have you got any Harrier memories, anything that comes to mind from Gary's interview?
I like his description of the original GR3 as a kind of an old school rally car.
That's all right.
No sort of like four-wheel drive or anything like that, or anything to kind of, you know, auto brakes or anything like that to keep you on the straight and narrow. It's just you in control of the machine. I think that's a really apt description of the early Harrier. If you think of it as kind of Mini Cooper or a Ford Escort barreling down some country lane at warp speed and kind of rallying around and that sort of stuff. Yeah,
I mean, Tim, that was a V-style aside. That was a very raw aircraft, wasn't it? Really.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very, you know, very, very simple and clever design in the first place, and there's a great lecture by obviously he mentioned John Farley as well, you know, the late great Mr. Harrier John Farley, and John used to do a lecture which was the VTOL Wheel of Misfortune, which was a whole load of things where people had tried to solve the problem of how do we make something that goes up and like a helicopter but flies as fast as a jet. And to this day, there's only really, you know, there's only the Harrier, V-22 and F-35B that have actually cracked it. But it's simple, you know, it's kind of simple, robust. And that's why you could get it out in the field. You know, the when it was developed, the feeling was, well, airfield's going to be targeted. You know, so we better spread these things out, and you had a quite robust and simple aircraft, and you know, I mean, we had Roland White on a couple of episodes ago, and it went down into the South Atlantic in fearsome weather, and people sort of say, well, you know, if you had the Phantoms down there, radar, etc., you know, two crews, but You know, maybe sometimes simple is better.
Yeah. And Tim, one of the points he made about the Pegasus engine, lovely name for his business, by the way, was the evolution of that engine from, was it 8,000 or 9,000 pound thrust to the US used Harriers today, 26,000-27,000 pound thrust from that same engine. Are we ever going to see British engineering like that again, design and engineering, or are we just going to see lots of Tempest F-35 type collaborative projects, do you think?
On propulsion or engines, I mean that's a great story. I mean, you know, looking up online, because I've not got the figures in my head, but it was apparently early ones were early P1127s, 11,500 pounds thrust, and then latest, you know, 23 or 27. So it massively increased the performance and, you know, how much payload it could carry, along with the big Harrier wing, you know, which was brought in with the AV8B. And obviously we had as the GR5, you know, GR7, GR9. What's interesting, I think, today is, so, you know, that the engines that power the Typhoon are, you know, massively powerful. And almost there's growth potential in there. I mean, there's growth potential in the you know, the EJ200s that produce power the Eurofighter. But it's almost that it's not needed at the moment. What would you do? There's also, you know, I mean, Eurofighter have got an aerodynamic modification kit that will, you know, increase the angle of attack, roll rate, and again, it's one of the things that the thing is so overpowered in the first place that none of the air forces are particularly. I wouldn't say interested. I mean, obviously, there's pilots would want more performance, want more stuff on it. You know, you want your aircraft to go faster, turn tighter, etc. But it's one of those things that is right down on the pecking order. The only reason they might actually bring it back is because of all these remote carriers, loyal wingmen that Eurofighters and Typhoons might have to carry in the future. Some of these might be quite big things like Storm Shadows you're looking about, and in that case, the you know, extra power from the engine, you know, for carrying all this stuff might be very useful. Yeah. One caveat to that is there is one interesting thing is that Beer Systems, Rolls Royce, and a company called Reaction Engines are looking at not turning a Typhoon or a Eurofighter hypersonic, but they are looking at using Reaction Engines' Sabre air-breathing rocket technology in conjunction with an EJ200. And basically the idea of that, well, the thing with that is the pre-cooler. So obviously when air comes into, this is very simplified and engine people are going to probably stop throwing things at their
you are now our resident propulsion expert. Yeah. So
obviously when air goes in a jet engine, it's sucked in, compressed, it's very hot, and the colder you can get it, the better. And obviously for something like Sabre, when you talk about hypersonics and they're talking about, you know, high Mach numbers for something like Skylon or going to space, you know, but the pre-cooler can actually also work for kind of slower speeds, and therefore you could I think what they're looking at is very, very high more fuel efficiency, more performance that way, not turning it, you know, massively faster, but you know, doing more of it and kind of increasing its performance that way. So, you know, EJ200, you know, it's still got a long future ahead of it, you know.
Wow, okay. Gareth, Airbus Marshall there talked about the liaison between the RAF and the Navy 10 years ago that's led pretty much to what we're seeing in the, you know, in 617 Squadron, and Queen Elizabeth and all those great things we're seeing now. One question I wanted to know the answer to is, did he get the chance to fly a Sea Harrier?
Now, I don't think he did. I would have to ask him specifically. You could ask him on Twitter, but you know, Gary was, as I said, was a Harrier pilot for his whole career, but I don't think he flew Sea Harrier. I could be wrong. Okay. But I don't think he did. I mean, he's such a great talker. I mean, you and I were chatting before we started, Peter. I could have, I could still be interviewing Gary now, probably. I mean, he's, you know,
for the record, I wanted that to go for 2 hours.
And I just wanted to go back to something Tim said, which one of the proudest personal things for me from those few weeks that where we did all of that coverage on Global Aviation Resource was the link with John Farley. Carl Drage, you know, my friend and photographer, we went down to Dunsfold, and it was going to be the last time that two Harriers visited Dunsfold. Now, they didn't make it in that day because of fog, unfortunately, but that was the day that I met John Farley and I interviewed him for Planes TV. Okay. And we just kind of hit it off, and he was such a lovely guy, and he was very friendly, and he was so funny. And I got home from that day not thinking too much else about it, and a couple of days later the landline rang here at home, and my wife picked the phone up. I was up in my office, and she called upstairs and said, "Gareth, there's a phone call for you." And I said, "Who is it?" And she went, "It's somebody called John Farley." And I went downstairs and got the phone and said, "Oh, John, hi John, it's Gareth." And he said, "Gareth, it was great to meet you last week. I'm so pleased you're doing all this coverage. What help do you need?"
Wow.
And we stayed in touch throughout that whole period. Then he wrote a piece for us about the V-Stole development with the shorts. Is it the SC5, Tim? I'm trying to think off the top of my head. That he flew, and he proofread our history pieces and helped us with technical information. And what a lovely, lovely guy. And obviously John passed away in 2018, and so it was nice to have the opportunity to talk to Gary, because John was one of the most highly regarded and loved characters, if you like, from the Harrier story. So that was really nice. So and that legacy is there now, Tim, isn't it? We've got, here we are 10 years later with a joint force and a V-Stole aircraft again. And as Gary said, none of that would have happened without the Harrier story.
Yeah, I think he hit the nail on the head there. I mean, if you, even 10 years ago, if you would have said RAF, RAF pals, in 2020, the CEO of 617 Squadron is going to be a Royal Navy officer, you know, it would have caused heads to explode, you know.
Probably been shot.
It would just do, so I think you set the groundwork there, you know, of Joint Force Harrier, you know, that it's not a, it's not a novel idea or concept, and look at it as well in the how, you know, that this is where sort of Harrier won its spurs in the Falklands, and now we've even gone not only from you know, our Royal Navy and RAF integrated in, you know, kind of our F-35 force, but we can now invite the U.S. Marine Corps on our new carrier, and they slot perfectly in.
Yeah,
and it's like they because they've been helping out. You know, everybody's been training over there in the U.S. They've come here, and now they're kind of part of Queen Elizabeth's carrier air wing.
Yeah. Well, look, I'd just like to thank Gary again. And we talked a little bit about his charitable efforts, which are kicking off next year. We'll put the link in the show notes. Please take a look at that. It's for the Royal Air Force Association. And if you can get behind that, or if you want to get on your bike and do some cycling, etc., then I know that Gary would love for you to get involved. It's a great, great, great cause. And huge thanks again to Gary for his time.
Are you fascinated by aviation and its history? Are you hungry to expand your knowledge? Then you're ready for The Aviation Historian. A compact format quarterly journal, The Aviation Historian is a cross between a magazine and a book. It uses the best authors and the best picture sources to explore the less well-known paths of the history of flying. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Ogee, that's me, and Nick Stroud, so you can trust it for quality, accuracy, and sheer passion for the subject. The Aviation Historian. We're print, we're digital, but we're not in the shops. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com. Are you ready for it?
Hi, it's Dave Homewood here from the Wings Over New Zealand show. New Zealand's a very aviation-minded country, and we have a diverse range of stories out there to tell. The Wings Over New Zealand show brings you all sorts of stories, such as interviews with pilots or ground crew, World War II veterans, post-war Air Force personnel, air show stories, historians, authors, warbird restorers, airline stories, recreational flyers and home builders, agricultural aviation such as top dressing, and a lot more. We've got an extensive archive that you can go back to and listen to all of the shows. And there are new shows coming out all the time. The Wings Over New Zealand show, bringing you New Zealand aviation stories since 2011.
I know a lot of people still miss the Harrier. You know, the photographers all miss seeing it at low level, or they visit missing Wittering and Cottesmore. But the other place we all know the Harrier from, of course, is air shows. And we all miss seeing the Harrier at air shows as we did for so many years. And I guess that's one of the reasons why the aircraft became so iconic. Now, Gary mentioned this in the interview, Peter, didn't he? But you asked on our social media, some of our listeners to tell us what they consider to be their iconic aircraft. And we've got, well, apart from the fact we got quite a lot, we've got some really interesting sort of talking points, haven't we?
It really was. And Gary described the three British iconic aircraft, the Spitfire, the Concorde and the Harrier. And it sort of made us think a little bit more about what everyone else perceived to be their iconic aircraft. So I'm going to quickly run through some of this and then we can maybe have our own thoughts about what we think. So it was more active on Twitter. Mike at Aircrew Interview, he was going for Concorde. Dan the Iceman, definitely an answer that depends on the generation. Majority of older generation will say World War II. Being of the younger, I would say Concorde 2. But he also goes on to say there's nothing like it before, since, and the SR-71's a strong second. Good friend of the show, Simon Jakubowski, said the F-14, ultimate carrier fighter and loads of Hollywood appeal. Rafal Tumbles said the Convair B-58 Hustler when anything was possible. We All Count said the Boeing 727. He saw it when he was a kid, loved the sound, loved those memories, and talks about the silhouette. Oh, well, Little Book of Aviation came up with the Spitfire. Lindsay Rumbold, good friend of the show, tricky decision. She lands for Concorde, but she also mentions, here's an interesting one, the English Electric Lightning. And if she were to go civil, you can't beat the 747. Glenn Towler from New Zealand mentioned the de Havilland Mosquito, the first multi-role aircraft ever, until the Tornado entered service in the 70s. Luke Anthony, here's one for you. The A320. It marked the beginning of the end of Boeing's dominance, and with 9,500 airframes built, it will be around for decades to come. Wow. And then finally, Matt Willis, who of course is Naval Air History on Twitter, said the Sopwith Camel, mainly because of Biggles, but also because when he was growing up, it was still widely believed that the aircraft had shot down the Red Baron. And a little side note, he says, it was also the top scoring British scout in World War One and was first operated by the Royal Naval Air Service, Fly Navy. So there's an eclectic mix of iconic aircraft.
So that is definitely a broader mix than I was expecting. I've got my own sort of thoughts on this, but come on, Tim, I'm going to put you on the spot. I mean, what would you consider to be iconic aircraft or your iconic aircraft?
Iconic. I mean, you can't really argue with some of the things on the list then, can you? I mean, you know, Spitfire, Concorde.
I think those two are nailed on.
Yeah.
Do we all agree? Concorde, yeah. And Spitfire, yeah, are nailed on.
Yeah.
So I would also go for SR-71.
Lancaster?
Yeah, that didn't come up.
I mean, in terms of, yeah, this side of the pond, as it were.
Yeah. And the Vulcan didn't come
up. Yeah. I think some of them are personal. And I think there's your kind of actual genuine iconic aircraft. So for me, I would say Victor. Yeah. Because my dad worked on them when he was in the Air Force. So to me, it's a really important, you know, aircraft. And I consider it to be quite an iconic aircraft. But, and this is what I was saying to you earlier, Peter, if Victor flew down a suburban high street on a Saturday morning, most people would look up and wouldn't have a clue what it was. And I think to be a true icon, it needs all the public's heads to turn and they know what it is. That's kind of what I think. So I actually think in that sense, it's probably quite a small number. I think Harrier is probably in it, but obviously it can't fly down the high street. It has to hover over the high street for people to realise what it is.
How about you, Tim?
Well, I'd say, one of the aircraft that have that breakout, the breakout recognition in the public, you know, even if they can't quite identify it, naming no names at national newspapers, but you know, the Spitfire, Concorde, 747, you know, SR-71 might just squeeze it in there.
Yeah,
a space shuttle. And maybe. Maybe not the Sop of Camel, but maybe the, you ask somebody say, right, draw me a World War One fighter, and you know, 9 times out of 10, it's going to be the Red Barons, you know, Fokker DL-1, isn't it?
I think that's true. Yeah,
it's a good shout.
And they probably won't know. They probably won't know what it is. But yeah, that's what they would draw.
Yeah. How about this then? Instead of thinking of what you see, what about what you hear? Because everyone, almost everyone, recognises the Merlin engine.
Yeah.
Almost.
That's absolutely recognisable.
And then the rest are just noisy. You know, you've got
Concorde
and any jets.
We're slightly... It'd be different for us, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I used to, when I was a wee nipper, when I was like 13 years old, and my dad used to take me to RAF Coltishall, we'd hear an aircraft taxi out, and my dad would be, oh, that'll be a Jaguar coming. And I'd say to my dad, nah, that's a Harrier. And there is a distinct difference between the two, and even now you can tell the difference. But probably, I'm going to guess probably Merlin is the only one, isn't it, for the sort of wider public?
Yeah.
Presumably, all the rest just sound like jets.
From a sad civil's viewpoint, I could identify various airliners when I was younger by their engine sound.
No, really?
Yeah. I mean, the easy one was the RB211. But I could identify the aircraft by the engine sound. That was when I was really, really geeky.
I think 20 or more years ago, I think people living under Concorde's flight path would have been able to sort of say,
yeah,
that's Concorde going over there on the, that's Speedbird 1,
No, you definitely could.
Yeah.
So I grew up in Brookmans Park, which is in Hertfordshire, and Brookmans Park is a beacon, and it is part of
holding
the
holding point.
Yeah, it's part of the Heathrow holding traffic network. I don't know if it still is. I'm not sure, but you could, you could instantly tell it was very, very different. You know, you'd run outside, but it was blatantly obvious when Concorde was flying over. Yeah.
Well, interesting. Well,
yes. So listen, thank you all for your contributions on that one. I'll tell you what, we'd love to hear any Harrier memories if you've got any. That'd be a great thing to see, maybe in the comments.
I just wanted to say, Gareth, you asked a question about memories of that event. Actually, what has really been fabulous this week on social media is the amazing photos of that last day and that last week. And funnily enough, I almost found those better than on the day where we were all scrabbling around on our phones trying to see who'd been photographing what, because the weather, as you said, was pretty rubbish.
It's horrendous. With hindsight,
you can sit in your lounge, put your big screen on, and the quality, and I've got to say, hand out to mention to Carl again, some of his stuff is just...
We shared his gallery of, I think it was about 60 images, and it was from that last that last period, wasn't it? It wasn't just the last day, and a lot of that is thanks to the lovely people at RAF Cottesmore and RAF Wittering at the time, the access that was able to be granted. But yeah, I mean, we're very lucky, aren't we, to have such a great record of that day. And God, what a shame that last day was just so horrific. I literally have just about defrosted 10 years. my dad was based at Cottesmore for 3 years, and my dad always used to say, when they were out on doing night shifts with the Victors when they were night flying, that they used to call it a lazy wind, and it just went straight through you. It didn't bother to go around you, and it's very high and it's very flat, as Gary said in the interview. And by crikey, it was cold. Yeah, it really was freezing. But
one final question then, Gareth, just before we sign off. When are we going to hear your dad's stories?
Yeah, that's a really good shout, actually, isn't it? And I'll tell you what, I'll try and do that in the new year when I'm allowed to visit him again.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, put you on the spot there.
Yeah, I'm welling up now. No, I haven't seen him for months and months and months. But he's a great talker. That, I don't know, maybe that's where I get a bit of it from or something. And maybe he and I should have a chat about his time in the Air Force, because it would be nice to get that down.
Yeah.
For me as well, you know, and the family and future generations. So no, that's a really nice shout, Peter. Thank you.
No worries.
So look, we're going to wrap it up. We hope you've enjoyed the episodes this year. It's been, it's been another great year. We haven't always recorded as often as we'd like to, but we've recorded as much as we can, and we will do exactly the same thing again next year. We've got no plans on knocking it on the head or calling it a day. I'm sure. Peter and Tim, before we do our normal sort of outro, would like to just join me in saying that we hope you have a wonderful Christmas and we have a great new year. It's been an absolute shocker this year, but let's hope that 2021 is a lot better, eh, chaps?
Stay
safe and keep well, everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Amen to that. Can't say that enough, really. Stay safe, definitely. So as usual, Peter, whereabouts can we find you online?
You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and in the Aviation Extended Twitter and Facebook pages. Just also like quick mention for the extended family of supporters. We got Mick Oakey and the team at the Aviation Historian. They help us promote the programme. And I'd also like to mention Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club and Andy Wright at Aircrew Book Review, who also helped to promote the show. So a big thank you to those folks. And of course, Dave Homewood down under in New Zealand as well. Thanks very much.
Yeah, well said, and thank you. Tim, whereabouts can we find you online?
Yeah, okay, so I'm tweeting at RES Tim R for all your terrible aviation puns and unbreaking aviation news. And aerosociety.com is where my day job is, and with the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Brilliant. Well, you can find me at Gareth_Stringer on Twitter and globalaviationresource.com. Show notes of the episode will be on aviation-extended.co.uk, and including in there will be details of Gary Waterfall's charity cycling effort. So please take a look at that. And I think Peter normally says that the music's coming in now. So we're going to thank White Hearts for that. We're going to thank Peter Dixon for doing our fabulous voiceovers. You'll find legal policy, use of our material. It's all on the website. Please ask us if you want to use anything you've heard on this episode. And aside from that, it's goodbye from Peter Johnson.
See you later. Thanks, folks.
Goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, all. See you next time.
It's goodbye from me, Gareth Stringer. Thank you for listening to episode 108 of Extended. Have a great Christmas. Have a great new year. And if we don't see you before, we'll see you in 2021. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. You're listening to Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
I can't remember what the last bit is. It was going so well.
I was so impressed then, Gareth.
Europe's right. You favourite...
Remember to stay tuned into this
aviation radio podcast.
That's all it is.
Listen, we've done it 107 times.
Cut it and extended and put the rest of it in the outtakes.
Okay. I don't know if it finishes well enough. Just do one more end, just in case that one.
I'll laugh now.
Right. Stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
And remember to stay tuned to this frequency. So forget it. It's not going to happen.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
Happy New Year.
Well done, Gareth.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.